if you were to turn on CNBC, then you were to turn on ESPN, imagine having two TVs right next to each other on those same channels. They feel very similar. Both have letters, numbers, stuff scrolling at the bottom of the screen. They usually have a talking dude, very excited about something, right? Excited about the team or excited about what the market's doing or an industry or whatever. There's stuff on the side of other numbers and letters and all of this stuff. It's probably not by coincidence that they look similar. I watch CNBC because I get all those numbers and the red and the green and what all that stuff means. But if your brain doesn't work that way, it's so intimidating to just join the conversation. You can see why some, especially women, throw their hands up in the air and go, I'm not getting in. I just can't. It's too much for me because the resources aren't directed for them.
This is A Joyful Rebellion, the podcast that explores that moment you realize the life and success you worked so hard to create didn't come with all the fulfillment you thought it would. I'm your host, James Walters, and I want you to be the author of your own story. Each week, I connect with people who inspire bold answers to the question, what do I do now to create a life I love? If you're ready to start answering that question for yourself, you're in the right place. So let's start A Joyful Rebellion. I talk a lot about relationships on this podcast, and today is no different. Well, maybe a little different. What's your relationship with money? Does thinking about your bank or investment accounts leave you feeling stressed or excited? Do you consider money to be simply a tool, or did someone in your past twist that Bible verse to convince you that it is the root of all evil? And what attitudes about money were you exposed to in your childhood that are holding you back all these years later? My guest today is Shari Rash, financial advisor and founder of Greenway Wealth Advisory. Shari has over 17 years of experience working in the financial services industry and is author of The Insider Secrets About Women and Money. We talk about how the lessons we either did or didn't learn about money from previous generations in our family could be holding us back from a healthy relationship with it. Shari's going to share insights she's learned about personal finance through the years, the differences between how men and women view finances, and she explains how to discover your spending personality. So grab your fancy latte and let's jump right in. Shari, it's so great to have you here because what this podcast is about that time where you think you did everything the right way, then you realize that either you did and you don't really love the result, or you didn't do anything right and you're trying to pick up the pieces and figure out, okay, what do I do next? There's really few things more important in our lives than the money that it takes to keep it going, whether that's to keep kids in clothes and fed or to have adventures. I love having adventures. I've designed my life around having a small house, big life. That's how I've designed it. And I'm so excited to talk to you today about money. Yeah, let's talk about money. I got a good list of questions here, but really with this podcast, we talk about family programming a lot. And that's what I'd love to talk with you today as it concerns money, because the way we were raised, the environment we were raised in, the things we overheard our parents talk about, the general attitudes towards all sorts of stuff, what kind of food you ate at the dinner table, how you took your vacations, did you take vacations, all of those things, and especially money, because I don't know about you, but where I grew up in the South, it was like religion and politics. You didn't really talk about it very much. Right. And especially my mom showed me how to write checks and things like that, but not at all the management of it or the philosophy of it. Part of what the Joyful Rebellion is about is dismantling some of that programming. Okay. Yeah, it's really about dismantling a lot of that programming that got you to the point in life to where maybe you felt stuck and you wanted to look beyond it. And so let's dive in about money.
This will be fun. I love talking about this. Whether we realize it or not, it's programmed into our brains and it's programmed from our parents, and they don't realize how they're programmed, and it just creates a cycle, and realizing it breaks it.
Yeah. And you actually wrote a book. It's called Insider Secrets About Women and Money. And I would imagine this theme comes up a little bit I guess your experience is your research when you're working with clients, when you're seeing the issues they go through. And I'm interested in diving into what are some of the themes that you do see or things that are common in terms of ways your clients maybe got that family programming and now you've got to help them unlearn what they grew up around for so many years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What are some of the things you see that are common amongst people you've worked with?
The themes I see when I'm speaking with my clients or potential clients about money, it's a wide range from not knowing what to do and then finally accepting the fact of I don't know what to do and I need help, all the way to I feel bad for spending money. This doesn't feel right.
Okay.
Or I feel bad that I'm successful. I'm one of the most successful people in my family. I'm making more money than what my parents made. And that just feels weird or wrong, or it goes against how I grew up. And a lot of times it is mostly negative feelings about money. It's never really positive, like I'm awesome because I make this amount, or I'm awesome because I totally feel like I have control over this thing that I somehow am expected to know what to do with, but yeah. I've never been taught it. No one ever talked to me about it. So most of the time it is negative, which is interesting because money isn't negative. It's not positive or negative. It's just it. It's a thing.
Right.
And we impose our own beliefs on it or feelings on it, really based on how we were raised, how we grew up, and conversations or lack thereof about money.
What you described sounds a little bit like they are burdened by the money, whether they make too much or whether they are burdened feeling like they are spending any of it. What are some of the common themes like with family programming that you can pick up on? It sounds like maybe the person who feels guilty about spending, maybe they grew up in a home that clipped a lot of coupons or really put a big importance on have to save money, got to save for a rainy day. You never know when the sky's going to fall out. With the people who feel burdened because they're making a lot of money, they're successful. What do you think is the underlying thing behind that? Were they maybe raised in a house where their parents talked about rich people and us versus them kind of a mentality? What are you picking up on there?
I think that's a lot of it. It is in us versus them, or clipping coupons, like you said, or being very mindful of every dollar that's going out. So now that if someone does have, the next generation does have money, or they've earned a good income or what have you, it almost feels like they're going against everything that they're supposed to stand for, or they're spending frivolously because they have this nagging feeling that it all could go away someday.
And they're looking at it in the sense of, oh, we've got to be ultra conservative to the point where they don't really live their lives the way maybe they want to.
A kind of a combination of a few different personalities, but generally speaking, you're a saver. I call it a hoarder. Sometimes if you're crazy about saving,
right.
You're a money hoarder.
Okay.
You're a spender. So you have that YOLO. I don't know if anyone says YOLO anymore, but you have that YOLO mentality. You only live once. A miser. So you feel bad about spending money. Very cost conscious, almost to a fault. Everyone has different money personalities, and you don't have to be one or the other. You could be a combination of few, but understanding that. So when you think of money, or even becoming conscious of your money thoughts, helps you to identify what you are. For example, I'm a little bit of a YOLO in some ways, but I'm a miser in other ways. I spend on things that some people deem frivolous, but I have a really good reason behind it. And then other things I'm super, super cheap on and I won't spend. So I have that inner struggle with myself. If you have a spouse or partner, you have to understand their spending personality or their money personality as well, because it's pretty uncommon for a couple to have the same exact money personalities.
Mm.
And you can identify your personality pretty quickly if you just reflect on what your internal thoughts are, or conversations are about money.
Right. I can look at my bank statement and I can see what my priorities are pretty quickly, because I see where I spend money, because it's all tracked now, because it's all in the debit card. And yeah, you get a really quick picture And I think I'm more YOLO myself, for sure. But in a lot of ways, I'm not. It's interesting. You just made me think of a friend of mine and how very different we are. So just in a conversation we had recently, I bought a new skillet, like a pan you cook in. And it was close to $200. And I'll never have to buy another one of those in my life. It's got the 5-ply stainless, all the things. And I've got similar pots from close to 30 years and they're still going. I just needed a different size. Whereas she's, oh my gosh, I would never spend that much money on a pan. And they've got like the $20 one you would get at Target. And they buy one probably every 2 years because the stuff starts peeling and it gets warped if the stove's too hot, that kind of thing. So they keep rolling through them. They'll probably end up spending more than me.
That's right.
What would you call that personality?
That's like a miser for your friend's personality, and the fact that they feel bad for spending, to them, that's a lot of money. They don't get the ROI on it. They don't get the return on investment. You see it in our household similar. We have the expensive pans because we cook so much, because one thing I hate to spend money on is going out to eat unnecessarily.
Okay. So that's the miser part.
The miser part. So we'll be out. I have 4 kids. Someone's always hungry. Someone's always thirsty. Someone's always asking for a snack. I will have bags of snacks and our water bottles in the car. And we wait till we get home, and it's never a question of going through the drive-thru. No, we'll make do when we get home, right. Have a snack, drink your water, you're okay. But we have the pans, and yes, they're not cheap, but we also know it's an investment. We cook 95% of our meals at home. We're going to get our money's worth out of it. So that's prioritizing, having a priority with your spending and making sure you get a return out of it. I had the conversation with my 13-year-old daughter this morning. She is a saver. She will not spend any money. She is very frugal. I recognize that at a very early age. And she said she wanted Birkenstocks, but not Birkenstocks, like the knockoffs. And I said, no, we'll buy you the Birkenstocks. And she's like, why? They're so expensive. I said, one, your feet are pretty close to not done growing. And we live in a warm place. You're going to get use out of them. And then I said, buy it right or buy it twice. You, if we buy the cheaper version, you're hard on your shoes. They're likely going to break, and we're just going to have to buy you another pair. Sometimes making that investment up front does save you more money in the end.
I notice with things like that, especially clothing, if you do spend a little bit more, you can definitely get a lot more life out of them. Those pans I'm talking about will be around long after I'm gone.
Yeah. It's sometimes if you're looking to make a purchase like that, and you might be second guessing it with anything, pans, coolers, lunch boxes with my kids, I buy the Pottery Barn lunch boxes. They're not cheap. But otherwise, when I used to buy the cheaper ones, I was buying 2 or 3 lunch boxes just throughout a school year, where I have ones that have lasted 5+ years.
Right.
If you think of, to make yourself feel better, if you're feeling a little uncomfortable about it, think about cost per use.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you're buying, a shirt or what have you, how many times are you going to use it, and what's the cost of it per use? Your pan will probably be 5 cents a use because you're using it so many times throughout your life. Where the less expensive pan, you only get 2 years out of it, your cost per use might actually be higher.
That's important to think about. You wrote a book about money. It's called Insider Secrets About Women and Money. Did you write it for women? Is it about women? What made you write it in that way? Did you start seeing a number of clients and you saw something that they all had in common? And you said, you know what? I need to get this message out to a specific audience. What was leading up to that?
I wrote it for women, from a woman's perspective, but also a woman that is in the financial services industry. I can talk the talk, but choose not to. I choose to make the way I speak about money very conversational and not intimidating, because it can be. So if you have someone talking to you at a very high level about a topic that already makes you uncomfortable, because money makes us all uncomfortable, and then they're using all these words that you don't understand or you're afraid to ask, it's not a productive conversation. So I really wrote it from the perspective of how I talk to my girlfriends about anything, right? It's just a very conversational topic. And I wrote it as, I've been an advisor but I also have been on the other side of the industry representing product companies. So I got to see the insides of all of those companies and how they operated and how women are really underserved by the financial services industry. One reason being it's mostly male dominated. I've been the only woman in a room most of my career in at meetings or conferences or what have you. So that's intimidating. So I get the intimidation part of it already. I wanted to address how women are underserved and why. And it's mainly because men and women think differently about money, generally speaking. And advisors tend to gravitate towards the male in the room. If they're sitting down with a husband and wife, for example, they tend to gravitate towards the male because they speak the similar money language than women do. Okay. So women are usually, they feel left out of the conversation, even if they're sitting in the room.
You just said there is a difference in the way men and women think about money. What is that? Is it a philosophical difference? Is it one thinks of it more as a tool? How do they think about it differently?
Women tend to think of money of what can it do for me? And men think of it in returns, pretty much. The easiest way for me to explain it is if you think about a college savings account that every parent set up for their kids, a 529, it's called. If you think about a 529 account, it's set up with the purpose of paying for college for your child. Women think of it as, what can this account do for me? It's going to pay for my kids' college. It's going to relieve some financial burden for them and for me. And men generally think of it as, how did it return? What return did it get for the year?
Okay.
It's feelings versus more, what is it doing performance-wise?
It's funny because as you said that about the men, it's almost in very much the same way that men look at sports and they want to keep the score. They want to know who's performing, what team do they need to be pulling for? And maybe it's not the 529 this time.
Yeah. I just got goosebumps because in my book, I talk about if you were to turn on CNBC and then you were to turn on ESPN, imagine having two TVs right next to each other on those same channels. I talk about this in my book. They feel very similar if you look at them. Both have things, letters, numbers, stuff scrolling at the bottom of the screen. They usually have a talking dude, very excited about something, right? Excited about the team or excited about what the market's doing or an industry or whatever. There's stuff on the side of other numbers and letters and all of this stuff. It's probably not by coincidence that they look similar. So I watch CNBC because I get all those numbers and the red and the green and what all that stuff means. And I could watch ESPN if I really wanted to. It's not very exciting to me, but that's so intimidating, especially if your brain doesn't work that way. It's so intimidating to just join the conversation. You can see why some, especially women, throw their hands up in the air and go, I'm not getting involved. I just can't. It's too much for me because the resources aren't directed for them.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense why you would want to write a book specifically for them to sort of bring back the curtain, demystify it a little bit, take some of the jargon out of it so it is more accessible and people can think about it, or the women that read the book can think about it in a different way. Not that it's overwhelming, but honestly, that financial planner is talking over the men's heads just as much. And they're just as overwhelmed, but they want to frame it in a sports analogy because that's something maybe they can understand a little bit better. But I've had the experience too that we're all just kind of nodding and hoping we understand what the heck they're talking about later on. So it's not a man-woman thing. It is definitely a human experience. If you got your financial news from a CNBC or anything, like, I'm not a sports person, so I call it sports ball. Doesn't matter what it is. Basketball. I'm in North Carolina. It's all about basketball this month. And I'm like, cool, sports ball. I love it. Go team. I don't know.
As long as both teams have fun, right? There's like a t-shirt. As long as everyone has fun.
Yeah. I remember vividly a Super Bowl Sunday a few years ago, and I was in the grocery store because that's when I was doing my shopping. Didn't know it was Super Bowl, didn't know what was going on. And guy at the checkout, he's like, yeah, who you pulling for today? And I was like, what do you mean? He's, oh, with the game. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm pulling for America, definitely. He just looked at me really strange. But that's how it is with me in sports, I can imagine. that's how it might be for some women when they're with an advisor who is talking all the jargon and not intentionally trying to talk over their head, but also not taking the time to explain exactly how this process goes, where it sounds like the guys are just trying to keep the score of, did we win? Did we lose? What's going on? Another thing I'm interested in is you say something about your first money memory and how it affects your relationship with money for the rest of your life. What do you mean by that?
If I were to ask you, when was the first time you were introduced to money, or tell me your first money memory? Everyone has it. We may have never given it a thought before, but once that question's asked and you actually sit there and think, most people can think of something. It may not be exactly your first money memory, but it may be what shapes your relationship with money. I can share mine. I remember I was 12 or 13 years old, and it was the summertime, and we were at the beach, and my parents have a house at the beach, and my dad said, Shari, you like all this stuff. You like buying stuff, which is what I value. I like buying stuff. And he's like, but I'm not going to be paying for it anymore. You need to get a job. So I'm this little kid. Okay, I'll get a job. And my mom took me around to different restaurants in this town to hire me because it's a summer job and tourism, obviously. It all made sense, right? And I was too young to work. I was like a year too young. Right. So everyone's, nope, you're too young. And it's, well, what am I going to do? I need to buy my stuff and no one's going to hire me. How am I going to make money? And then finally a restaurant hired me and they just made up this job. I made toast for breakfast. I was a toast girl and I took my job very seriously and I was getting paid hourly. But then after my first shift, the servers tipped me out too. So they tipped out the bussers, but they tipped out me.
Oh, fun.
So I come home with all of the like gobs of cash and I'm just like pulling it out of my apron, all this cash. And every weekend I worked and I got this and I could see it and I put it in different piles and I organized it. And then I would go and buy my little trinkets and purses and stuff that a 12 or 13 year old kid buys and not the Lululemon that my kids buy.
Yeah.
That was it. It was immediate grat. You work, you get this money and then you can go do with it. You can see it. I can touch it. I can put it in my drawer and save it and put it in the bank or spend it. And that kind of created my relationship with money.
I bet that felt really empowering too, because you're like, this is my money. No one's going to tell me no because it's mine.
That's right. Wow. I made it. And my parents, they were like, this kind of backfired. We were expecting you to make a few bucks a day and you're coming home with $100.
Yeah.
Crazy. But it that was it. And that changed my relationship with, and established my relationship with money going forward.
And you felt like you were really in control of it. Sounds like. So that was super empowering.
It was, because I decided I was saving half of it for whatever I was saving it for. Mm. And then I got to spend the other part of it and I could see it. And it really just gave me the control and the empowerment, like you said, that I didn't even realize I needed or wanted, but I did.
I can imagine your parents like, oh, I thought we were going to really have a teachable lesson here, but it sounds like they learned the lesson more than you did. So that's really good. Now, I know that when someone grows up in a household, their parents are going to have attitudes about money and toward money that they're going to pass on to their kids. And they probably got those attitudes from their parents. I hear a lot of people talking about how their financial advisor looks at them. And when I say these people are probably now in their 50s, so they would be Generation X, and their financial advisor looks at them and says, you're operating on depression era thinking about money, because maybe they were close to their grandparents or their grandparents just instilled into their parents this attitude or thoughts about money. In your work, working with people and helping them understand their finances, what do you see in the different generations now? So let's say from the boomers to the Xers to the millennials that you work with, how have the attitudes towards money changed in general?
That's a good question.
Because I would imagine that the boomers were all growing up in houses where it was save, bury cash in the backyard and coffee tins, right, and just make sure you always have cash around. And then the Xers, we were that generation. A lot of us saw their parents struggle, like with jobs. That was the first generation that really saw their parents get downsized in some households, not all households, but that was when corporate America, you realized that your job wasn't quite so safe. And there was a whole set of thoughts and attitudes about money that went with that. And I don't know what kind of households the millennials were growing up in, because I don't have experience with that.
It's interesting. I agree with what boomers, what they saw with their parents, and they experienced more of a hoarding or negative with money because, like you said, downsizing and all. I would say there's also a shift with the transition from employers providing pension plans to not. If we think about a lot of boomers and maybe some Gen Xers, but not so much, or the Gen Xers saw it, they witnessed it with their parents. You worked for the same company for 30 years. You retired, you got the gold watch, and you got the pension, right? So you didn't have to think about retirement, where now we're solely responsible for our retirement, right? Most, I would say 99% of companies don't offer a pension plan or anything like that. So now it's up to us, which is a foreign concept, right? That's only changed over a generation. So now we're solely responsible for it. That's definitely a mindset shift, not having someone else pay for your retirement, pay for your future. Moving companies as well is also more of a foreign concept because, like I said before, you work for the same company for 30 years and now we're switching jobs every 4 years on average.
Yeah.
And millennials are in a interesting spot. Now, millennial, I'm a millennial, but, and I'm not necessarily an elder millennial, but I'm not a young millennial either. I'm in between, but there's student loans. There's super high housing costs. Millennials are to the game, generally speaking, of buying a home. Most of the average age last year, I believe, was like 35, which is old to buy your first home, historically speaking,
right?
Because there's student loan debt. To buy a car is as much as many people's mortgages 30 years ago, what a car payment is today. There's so many expenses today where didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. Think about cell phone, cable, and all these really high expenses. So there's a lot more stressors, I think, today. Also, Gen Xers may also prioritize paying for education, their kids' education. They may have not gone to college or had to have their own or didn't have the opportunity or what have you. So prioritizing paying for education is a big thing that I see among the younger generations now. So I would say the priorities or goals have shifted depending on who I'm speaking with.
I see that now that you describe it that way, a lot of the conversations I have with friends and just people in general definitely fall into those categories of making sure their kids are covered for tuitions and just opportunities, really, is what it comes down to. And using money to help get them a leg up because everything is so competitive.
I hear of people starting as soon as your kid has earned income, they can have retirement accounts, which is pretty crazy. So when I was making my toast, I could have been opening up Roth IRAs for myself, but that wasn't on anyone's radar. Today, that's on parents' radars, and they're doing that for their kids.
Yeah.
The Secure Act 2.0 that passed at the end of 2022, that now allows, if you don't use up all the money in a 529, you can then roll that into a Roth IRA. So then your kid, when they graduate college, now has a retirement account that's not going to be taxed ever by the government as long as they follow the rules of it, which is pretty amazing. So now we're becoming more aware of, okay, we have this tool. We need to use it as more than just earning and spending, right? We need to figure out ways to use this tool to not only our benefit, but our kids' benefit as well.
Yeah. And when it comes to kids, how are you talking with your kids about money? And how are you talking with them at the different stages? Let's say under five and then five to, what are the stages that you see developmentally when you're talking with kids about money?
Yeah. So it's probably not surprising that I talk to my kids about money all the time. But the thing is, with talking about money, and I think that this is one mindset shift that we all have to make, is talking about money doesn't mean I'm telling everyone how much is in my bank account or how much money I'm making. It's talking about money is how to make wise decisions with money. And kids today are instant gratification, right? Mm-hmm. So teaching them to make decisions with their money that their future self may appreciate. I think one of the best ways to teach kids about money is through an allowance. And there's so many different schools of thought about allowance. I mentioned my oldest daughter is very frugal. My middle daughter is a spender. If she has $5 in her pocket, she is spending all $5 and planning on what she's going to do with the next $5 that she somehow obtains. They're very different, so I can't treat them the same way when it right. comes to money, because I can quickly identify their personalities. So as far as allowance goes, that's a great way. And there's a couple schools of thought with it. You could just pay your kid an allowance because they're a member of the household. And since you're a member of this household, it's expected that you contribute by taking out the trash or emptying the dishwasher or what have you. You can have an allowance and assign a dollar amount based on the chore that they do. Emptying the dishwasher, you get a buck. If you take out the trash because it's super gross and it's heavy, you get $3. Whatever you want to do and come up with it. And then once you have a system that works for you as far as allowance goes, or it could just be, hey, when you need money, I'm going to give it to you. But mm-hmm. it's expected that you're going to help around the house, whatever it is, but giving them some responsibility for it. But then when they have their allowance, what are we going to do with it? Do you want to go to Target and buy a toy? Do you want to save some money and buy an even bigger toy or something else super cool in a few months? What is the purpose of this money? Do we want to take our money to the bank and put our money in the bank and they keep it safe for you? And we just hold on to a little bit of cash for right now. It's all different parts of the conversation. My kids have fundraisers in school for different nonprofits. Do you want to give some of your allowance to that? And that feels really good when you do that, right? Versus just, hey, Mom, we're having a fundraiser, send us in some money. Why don't we use your money? And that
makes it real.
It makes it real and you can feel it. Yeah. So incorporating money talk into your everyday life and empowering them to make the decision. With my 4-year-old, she wants this Barbie at Target. We're not buying toys today, but you're going to get, she doesn't get an allowance yet, but hey, you have some birthday money left over. Do you want to use that to buy your Barbie? Yeah, okay. Or no, I don't want to.
Yeah.
So letting them make that decision. And so just doing little things to have them make decisions, feel empowered, gain control over something that at the end of the day isn't that big of a deal, buying a Barbie or not.
Right.
So then it is.
It is funny how I've seen my daughter reprioritize in a hurry. Maybe she wants some ice cream. And I said, okay, yeah, we can get some ice cream. Did you bring your money? And she's, oh, if I've got to pay for it, I don't want ice cream.
That's right.
And I'm like, wow, okay, that's one way to do it. But yep. You can see them really figure out what's important to them if their money is on the line.
That's right.
When you were writing your book and you wanted to make financial education more accessible to the women who were reading it, how did you go through the different personalities and how did you speak to each one of those and maybe help them figure out what their personality was and then what to do with it next?
Even when I have a conversation, if I'm sitting down with a husband and wife, I have to change the way I speak. So I'll repeat the same sentence, but based on their different personalities. So talking about the 529 again, the college savings account. Okay, the account returned 17% last year. That speaks to the male, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. That means based on that projection, you're going to have enough money to cover 2 years worth of tuition. Okay. Oh, okay. So I said I broke my sentence down into two different ways of explaining it. And it appealed to both of them, where if I just said the account returned 17% this year and moved on, the wife, generally speaking, wouldn't understand what that meant for her because that's not her language. So I tried to say the same thing in different ways to appeal to all of the readers. I also explain all the different money personalities. So then hopefully you can identify who you are pretty quickly and have that mentality as you're reading it. And also reminding that we impose our own feelings on money. And it doesn't mean we're right and wrong, but we also have to be aware of it. Mm-hmm. So trying to remove the person, the emotion from it, we need to try to remove it because at the end of the day, it's numbers, it's facts and figures. Having $500 in your bank account may make you feel upset, but someone else may think that's a fantastic number to have. So right. neither of you yeah. are right or wrong, but acknowledging the feeling that we're imposing on something that really is neutral.
So if you were talking with someone and they realized that their money personality was of a miser and they wanted to just get your thoughts on, okay, wait, this is my money personality. What's the best way to either leverage that or recover from that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just the word miser, it just sounds, I just want to go run or something, run away from it. What would be your advice to someone like that? In their we're attitude often, toward money.
Yeah, we're in our own heads about everything, right? Mm. So sometimes with my clients that feel bad about spending money, I'm just giving them the permission to. Yeah. It's okay, you can do it. I have a couple and they're so fun and they're so hilarious and they acknowledge, we know nothing about money, you're our person, and they have enough. They're retired, they have enough by every simulation I can create, they're fine. Yeah. And I tell them that you're fine, spend your money. And they, my financial advisor says I can spend my money and I have plenty of money to spend. And sometimes you need to hear that. So yeah. I've had clients say to me, I want to buy a computer. I want to get this. Can I do it? And it's almost just me giving them the permission. You can do it. And it's wow. okay, good. Okay. And you can see the weight just lifted. Okay, I can do it. It's okay.
Yeah.
And that helps.
As an advisor, what are some of the more difficult conversations you have to have with people? Are those with maybe the spenders? Are those the more typical difficult conversations?
Everyone can Google financial advice, right? And a lot of it's not rocket science. But again, we impose our own emotions on it, or it's overwhelming, or the person's not speaking our language. So the information doesn't click. So if you look up, how do I manage my money, or how do I budget or something? You're going to see the traditional budgeting of stop spending, especially for millennials, stop buying your $5 cup of coffee right. and your $11 avocado toast, right? Yeah. And I don't subscribe to that, because as I'm drinking my $5 cup of coffee that I have twice a year, I'm literally my 13-year-old, can you take me to Starbucks this morning? And I'm like, but yeah, I will, because I haven't gone in 6 months. You're not going to get that advice from me, because that $5 cup of coffee may be your only joy that day, mm-hmm. right? That may be the best part of your day. And who am I to take that away from you? But if that means that's kicking us over into territory where it's a problem, then we have to acknowledge it. We only have so much money coming in, which means we have to have less than that going out, right? Mm-hmm. My recommendation is to put guardrails around your spending categories instead of budgets. So having guardrails around your spending helps you feel a little bit more empowered, because I am going to buy my $5 cup of coffee today, but that means I might not do something else 2 weeks from now, because I gratified myself. I gave myself something I like. I don't feel like I'm going without. Yeah. So making choices where, again, you feel like you're in control and you're empowered, but you're not punishing yourself, because, again, we're putting our emotions onto something that doesn't have emotion.
That's what gives it the power, is that emotion, either for good or evil. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh. Wow. So after you wrote the book, you put the book out there, what kind of feedback did you start getting from people when they read the book? What were some revelations or some common feedback you were getting?
A lot of it was, this is information that I knew I needed, but I didn't know where to find it.
Okay.
Or it felt as if you were speaking right to me. Definitely a lot of light bulbs going off, and more of, I need to be involved more with my money and with decisions. Women typically manage the day-to-day decision, money spending, but the big decisions are left up to their husbands, mm-hmm. generally speaking. So getting more involved, and we often think because we're involved in the day-to-day, check the box, I'm involved with my money, but you're not, because the big stuff is really, that is what can dramatically impact. So I need to get more involved. And I say, you don't need to track every stock or watch it on TV or, you know, have the app on your phone and open up everything and look at your accounts every day. That's not productive. If something were to happen to your spouse, knowing who to talk to, knowing who to contact, knowing that you can handle this and you know where all of your money is, that's important. So it helped people feel empowered to get involved in the bigger element of their finances, but still at a place where they feel comfortable. Not totally diving into foreign waters, having more of an understanding and not just sticking our head in the sand.
I'm wondering if you have a story where a person came to you and they were just kind of clueless about their financial situation and gave you all the information that they had, and you worked with them to do kind of a financial makeover. Do you have any examples of where they were versus where they are now and how much more empowered they feel from working with you?
I have one client and we're still working on it, but I'm really enjoying the journey that we're on together. So it's nowhere near complete, but we're already doing a ton of work. She's young, she's in her 20s, but she works for herself. She's an entrepreneur. She was never taught how to manage her money. So it's finding this new program is going to change my business and bring in so much money. So I'm going to spend X amount of money on this, or I'm just robbing Peter to pay Paul as far as my business accounts go, my personal accounts, and I don't think I can make payroll. So taking a step backwards and understanding the very first fundamental financial lesson is you can't have more money going out than what's coming in. So where do we make an edit? And going through how she spends personally and with the business, right? Because just because the business is paying for it when you're self-employed, you're still paying for it.
You're paying for it, right? Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's a write-off, it's still your money that you're spending, right? Mm-hmm. It's not this pot of money that's just sitting there to spend. So undoing that mentality a little bit, understanding where your money is going and then being selective about it. She now feels in control. The restrictions that we put in as far as understanding, making decisions, asking yourself, do I really need to spend, is actually making her feel more empowered. It's like discipline creates freedom. Now that she has a discipline around her business and personal expenses, and then a discipline around having a profit first mentality, which is what I practice with my business owner clients, having a profit first mentality has now created the freedom of feeling like she has control. Because when you're a business owner, whether you're a doctor, a chiropractor, a marketer, a photographer, whatever you are, you know your skill, but we're somehow expected to understand how to run a business too, which isn't fair. It's not fair to us business owners. And again, you can read the books, you can listen to the podcast, you can do all these things, but if they're not speaking your language, or if they're not speaking in a way that resonates with you, or it's overwhelming, it doesn't translate, doesn't sink in.
That got me thinking about the fact that as we're talking about a lot of these attitudes towards money or money personalities, we've been talking a little bit about traditional roles like husband, wife, married dynamics, but a lot of people are waiting much later in life to get married. Whereas 30 years ago, maybe it was common for people in their early 20s to get married. Now it's pretty much late 20s, early 30s. For men and women, there's a pretty solid amount of time between the time that they left the nest, they've gone through college, maybe they've racked up that college debt, and now they're in the working world trying to figure out how to make it happen. Then they get married and they come together and all their good and bad habits meld and mesh. Do you ever find yourself having to do some marriage counseling?
Yes. Yes. And I love it. I got so excited when you were asking this question. Most of my meetings are half therapy,
right?
I clients cry with me. We laugh together because it's a burden. It's a stressor. It provides joy and pain and all these things. And can you imagine a couple, two 40-year-olds that have lived their own lives, their own careers, done their own thing, and then they're getting married to each other for the first time? Then wait a minute. I've put all my money in the same account as you, and now you're going to see everything that I spend. And I think, what? I've been doing my own thing for 20 plus years.
Yeah,
right? I mean, it's a complete different paradigm shift. So every client that works with me, they go through my program that I created called Financial Foundations. And with that, we talk about first bank accounts, because most financial advisors won't talk to you about your checking account or savings account or emergency fund. Because one, it's not sexy, and two, they don't make any money off of it. So let's just talk about your investments. Let's talk about your 401k, your IRAs, all of that. But oftentimes, we can't make big financial decisions like what to do with our retirement account if we're not confident or feel secure in the strategy for our emergency fund. I will talk to couples, and there's no right answer, right? There's couples that have their own personal checking accounts, and then they have a joint account. But then one person makes double what the other one makes. Is it fair to expect them to contribute the same dollar amount to the household? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, right? So we talk through all of those things. So what do you want your bank accounts to look like? What's the purpose? You both make your own money. You have obviously joint expenses. How are we going to tackle it? It never gets contentious. It's never an ugly conversation because it doesn't need to be, right? Let's remove the emotion. You make double what he makes. So right. He'd be out of money if he contributed the same amount that you did to your joint bank account. So what's a fair number? And just coming at it that way, I had a client tell me once, and it was one of the best compliments I ever received. Once my husband and I get to the point of starting to get a little hairy about money or start feeling like an argument could brew, we just say, put it on the list to talk to Shari about. You've removed all of our money fighting in our relationship, which is amazing, it's my goal. So there's no right or wrong answer as far as what couples should do with their money or how to have their account set up, but have a conversation about it and ideally have it with a third party who's totally neutral, doesn't have any skin in the game.
Maybe wear your referee shirt to that meeting.
Blow my whistle.
Exactly. That's great. If someone is listening right now and wants to know how to get in touch or even work with you, what's the best way for them to reach you?
My website, greenwaywealthadvisory.com. And there you can schedule an intro call. It's called Start the Conversation. It's just a time where we just talk things out. What are your fears? What are you looking to achieve? No numbers, nothing's discussed like that. It's just what impact does money have on your life and what do you want to achieve going forward? So greenwaywealthadvisory.com and schedule time to start the conversation.
That's great. And at what point do you recommend people really start seeking out a financial advisor? Is it when they get a job and start making their own money?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a question about money, yes, you can Google it, but really that's the time. If you have questions about money, that means you're curious, you want to take actionable steps. That's when you should seek it out. And an advisor should really act in a advice capacity. So having an advisor that works in a fiduciary capacity is working in your best interest and providing ongoing advice. That's really what you need.
I would imagine you do a lot of work around crystallizing what their goals are, because you can't really hit a target if you don't know what the target is you're hitting. So I would imagine you get people who come to you like, hey, I just want to do the best with my money that I can. And then you have to maybe re-aim to, okay, what does that mean for you? Do you have a lot of those conversations?
Yeah. So a lot of it is, are we going to be okay? Are we doing the right things? Saving is a lot more fun when it has a goal. And we start very simply. How much money is a good number in your checking account? And everyone has a different answer. Then how much should we have in an emergency fund? And again, there's rules of thumb, but everyone has a different answer. Once we have that taken care of, that's when we know if something bad were to happen, we don't have to take on debt to solve it. And then we can move on to the more fun stuff or what we feel is necessary. So paying for education, retirement, buying a home, making renovations, travel, whatever is important to you. Once we have the basic kind of not fun stuff taken care of, that's when we can start focusing on the fun stuff.
I like the fun stuff.
Yeah.
But you got to eat your vegetables too, so you can stay, okay, quote, healthy and all that.
And eat them first, get it over with, and then you move on.
Yeah, then eat dessert.
Yeah.
You won't even remember those vegetables by the end of the meal.
That's right.
Shari, thank you so much for this conversation. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you would like to talk about? I know we talked about a ton of stuff, from family dynamics and how that affects people's money attitudes to the personality. Is there anything you'd like to discuss?
I would just say, don't feel like you have to go at it on your own. Mm. And if you want to start working with an advisor, take recommendations from friends and family, but know that they're very different from you, and interview a few. You'll get a feeling right away. Whoever you work with, and everyone needs a financial partner in their corner, but that person, I say the advisor you should work with is the one that you're going to call when good things and bad things happen in your life. And if you can't picture yourself calling that person when you lose a job, when you have a baby, when you're moving, when you're buying a home, then they're not a right fit for you. So take your time, interview, you're dating, go talk with advisors, and you'll find the right one for you. But as soon as you start having financial questions is when you should start looking for one.
Great advice. I love it. Shari, thank you so much for being on A Joyful Rebellion. And I will look forward to talking with people and getting their feedback and maybe having a follow-up conversation with you about what I hear from them.
I'd love that. It was so much fun. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining me today. And if you have an extra minute, I have a favor to ask. Some of you listen to this show on Apple Podcasts, and a lot of you I talk to are on Spotify or Amazon. I'd love it if you would take just a second to leave a rating or a review. It lets the platforms know that listeners are getting value from the show and suggest it to others who are interested in similar content. And as always, if you have a topic you'd like me to cover, a guest suggestion, or just general feedback, I'd love to hear about that too. Connect with me on Facebook, Instagram, or at ajoyfulrebellion.com.